Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Joseph P. Fonfara, 18538, representing Andrew Kaywood, the appellant in this matter. May it please the court?
Yes, you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. This is a criminal case, as I'm sure you're all aware. In 2006, defendant at the time, appellant now, Andrew Kaywood, was charged with basically theft of a bicycle, and to be technical, he was receiving stolen goods. Shortly thereafter, with actually just a few months, he was charged with a sexual assault in case 06-CR-1768, which forms the gist of this appeal. That's the case that we're dealing with. There was a disposition set on both, a global disposition for the two of them, was scheduled for January of 2007. And at that point in time, Judge Kalp in Larimer County ordered the PSIR, pre-sentence investigation report, along with the evaluations and along with the risk assessment, as he was required to do by statute. At the time, Mr. Kaywood was in remand at the Larimer County Detention Center pending sentencing. While there, he picked up a new charge, which was a second-degree assault. And at that point in time, and as a consequence of the new charge, they reevaluated the plea bargain arrangement he had made in his disposition, and he withdrew his plea. And it was decided then that he would seek a global settlement for the three cases, which did occur. In January of 2007, they did achieve a disposition on all three together. And at that point in time, sentencing for all three was set for July 8th of 2008. But at that time, the judge did not order an updated risk assessment, did order a new PSR, and did order an additional evaluation. And that did not occur. He did not have that. Sentencing did occur, but it occurred without the benefit of the risk assessment and with only a partial evaluation as required per statute.
Was that contained in the original PSI?
I'm sorry.
Months earlier, there was also that PSI did not include the risk analysis?
It did.
So we're talking about a lapse of a few months between
a
PSI, which in your view would satisfy the requirement, and one that was taken later.
Yes, if I may clarify, Your Honor. The first scheduled sentencing did include a PSIR, with an evaluation and the risk assessment according to statute, and it was actually performed in February of 2007. When he ultimately came for the sentencing on July 8th, 2008, which was 16 months later, then he came for sentencing. But at that point in time, the evaluation was only partial, and there was no risk assessment ordered at all and did not occur at that point in time. And that is a mandatory item per statute, as we stated in our brief, which forms greatly the gist of our appeal. But the second one did not, and we are not contending that the first one suffices. To meet.
Is the first one, as a matter of law, not valid?
Yes. It has to be done pursuant to 16.11.7, I believe, 105. It's only good for 6 months. As we generically said, it has a shelf life of 6 months. The fact that the sentencing occurred 16 months later made it grossly outdated. And so our position is that it was not suffice and does not suffice then for the second sentencing or the only sentencing. But the later sentencing date. Any other questions?
Well, so keep going. It sounds like there's a chronology of events here that you're going through.
Yes, thank you. So he, Mr. Kaywood, then was sentenced on July 2008, and what he received was a sentence for 10 years to life on SOISP, sexual offender intensive supervised probation, for the second degree or for the sexual assault. He was given 2 years probation for the which then became false information to a pawnbroker. And then the new charge that he picked up in the LCDC, the secondary assault, he was given 3 years of DOC. The two probationary sentences were to run concurrent. Of course, the sexual offense being 10 years was significantly longer, but the 2 years was subsumed into that. And then the DOC sentence of 3 years, which he successfully completed. He did that. And then the day he was released from DOC, then he started his probationary sentence. And things were going along fine for a while. But then he entered into an unapproved relationship with a coworker where he was working, and he was on probation. That was not permissible pursuant to the terms of his probation, so his probation was ultimately revoked. When that happened, and I should say prior to the revocation, he and I discovered that actually we felt that the original sentence was not legal and that it was not done in accord with the statute. And we filed motions with the district court in Fort Collins. At this point in time, Judge Lamons was the district court judge rather than Judge Kelp.
What was it that you believe was not legal or proper about the initial sentence?
The statutes require that there should be a PSR, obviously that's required, along with this SO, sexual offender evaluation, and a risk assessment. And all of them are mandatory pursuant to statute.
And what was missing in the first
one? The risk assessment, which would consist of a penile plethysmograph or an ABLE screening, and they were not given at all. They were February of 2007, 16 months prior, but for the sentencing that occurred in July 8th of 2008, they were not given. And so it's our belief and understanding, and it's still my belief today, that renders this a void sentence because it was not in compliance with the statutory scheme.
But as part of the chronology that you're giving, you just indicated that there was a revocation that occurred.
Yes.
And a resentencing that occurred. Did the risk assessment occur at that point in time?
Did not.
It did not?
No.
So he was not, there was no risk assessment that went into?
That is correct. Now, I've been advised from reading the answer brief put forth by the people that there have been some subsequent risk assessments done while he was in DOC, and I have no information either way on that, but I have no reason to doubt that. I suspect that it's probably true, but it's our position that does not suffice to substitute for the mandatory initial risk assessment that should have been given prior to sentencing.
Why not?
Because it's not prior to sentencing. The statute requires that before he can be sentenced, and the statute referring to 1611.7, I believe, 105, is that those should be given within, they have to be given before sentencing, unless it had been given within the preceding 6 months, which did not happen.
Which sentence are you appealing? The one he's presently serving or the one from which the probation was revoked?
Both, Your Honor. And why I say that was we had actually filed two appeals. The one we're here for today is for the first sentence that it was not given. And then we also had protested and objected and sent a motion to Judge Lamons regarding the revocation, stating that the revocation should not occur because the first sentence was not a legal sentence, or at least a void sentence, and because of a lack of subject matter jurisdiction on the part of the court, and therefore a revocation should not go forward for that reason, is that the sentence was not valid. And so we filed a second appeal on that. This court deemed the second appeal to be similar issues to the first and consolidated the two. So I'm here today speaking on both appeals. But to answer your question, it's actually both sentencings that we're objecting to.
Can you go back to the risk assessment that occurred at the DOC? How is that relief different than what you're seeking? I thought you were seeking a risk assessment that you said was lacking in the original sentence.
Not quite, Your Honor, if I may explain that. For one thing, I do not know for sure that a risk assessment was given at the DOC. I'm stating that on the people's answer brief, the people state that it had been given. I have not been able to confirm that, so I have no information that, in fact, it was given. But I don't believe that we're not just looking for a risk assessment. There are many factors above and beyond that. One is that he's revoked and his SOISP sentence is then translated into a possible lifetime DOC sentence, and it's indeterminate sentencing. So now, instead of being on SOISP, he's serving time in the DOC and possibly for the remainder of his life. And it is our petition and our contention that had it been done properly, now he may have been put on probation at the time had it been done properly. I can't say that it wouldn't have happened. And if he's successful on appeal and if he gets resentenced, again, he could be sentenced to DOC. We know that's a possibility. But nonetheless, at that point in time, he would not have been on probation because it was an illegal sentence. So our position is that the SOISP sentence is not a legal sentence, a void sentence, so he would not have been on probation when the allegations are that he violated it through his unauthorized relationship. And if that were the case, he would have no restrictions regarding the relationship, and therefore he would not have had a probationary sentence to be revoked. And so our position, which is also why we contest the fact that people stated being a moot sentence, because it does create a benefit to him if we're successful in the appeal. In that, then our position is that he'd go back for resentencing, and then we would hope that the judge would sentence him to a probationary sentence as he originally did, but done so properly with the risk assessment. And now the risk assessment subsequently, while they may or may not have covered some of the issues that would have been developed in the first place, I have no way of knowing. We do take the position that it does not suffice to substitute for the initial one that should have been given.
Pardon me, counsel, I'm having difficulty understanding why you're contending that this is an illegal sentence as opposed to a sentence that was imposed in an illegal manner. Are you saying that the sentence that was given is not a sentence that could have been given under the statute, setting aside for a moment the fact that the plethysmograph and the ABLE test were not done? But isn't this a sentence that was permitted to be imposed by the statutes?
If it pleases the court, I'd like to break that down into a couple of separate components. I believe what you're saying, as I understand in the event what you're saying, that the sentence he was given would be, as far as the punitive function or the penalty phase, that it is within the statutes, and so it's legal in that aspect.
Right.
But why I say that is not legal in overall in a void sense is that, and I understand certain cases, Winziger and some of the others would state that it just simply wasn't done in a proper fashion. We disagree with that.
Aren't we bound by some of that case law?
Yes, we are. But there's also a case law that countermands that says that that sentencing must be in full compliance with the statutory scheme. The legislature mandated these tests before sentencing, and so part of the statutory scheme would include these tests. And it is not merely the penalty phase, but the entire process is statutory. And I argue that that is quite distinguishable from a procedural defect, which would create a voidable sentence, which would come under the 120-day guidelines for filing an objection. And this did not. Mr. Kaywood did not file within 120 days. But the reason for that is that it was a void sentence, because the statutory scheme was not complied with. And I will state that I have researched this as thorough as I possibly could, and I have found no case law at all, nor statutes, that state that the penalty phase is the only statute that must be looked at to find out what's void or voidable sentence.
So is no portion of the pre-sentence evaluation process, is none of that waivable?
No, it is not waivable. As a matter of fact, the legislature in 16.11.7, I believe it's 104, states that notwithstanding the fact that if it's not given within 16 months, it cannot be waived. It is a mandatory requirement.
Every element of it is mandatory, you're saying?
Yes. And the language is very clear by the legislature. And Your Honor, it looks like I've only got 2 minutes left. I would like to reserve that time, if I may, if that would please the court.
Yes, you may, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. In his opening brief, the defendant challenges the trial court's March 10th, 2011 order, which denied the defendant's claim that his former sentence to probation was illegal. Although he filed a separate appeal from his revocation and subsequent sentencing after that, I believe the opening brief is specifically limited to that order, and that's the issue that's before this court. Although I raised a number of arguments supporting the trial court's order in my answer brief, I'd like to focus on one today, which is that the defendant presented a time-barred illegal manner claim. As another division of this court properly found in People versus Collier, 151 P3rd 668, the defendant's assertion that he did not receive the complete range of psychological and physiological testing in his sex offender evaluation before he was sentenced is a claim that his sentence was imposed in an illegal manner. Accordingly, that claim needed to be brought within 120 days of sentencing, and the defendant here did not do so. Therefore, his claim is time-barred under Criminal Rules of Procedure 35A and B. If there are no further questions, the people ask this court to, from the trial court, sir. That would certainly be helpful.
Yeah, I want to go back to, I understand the People v. Collier and the time bar argument. I want to go back to the mootness argument because I don't quite have a good handle on that one based on the discussion earlier.
Absolutely.
That took place. Your counterpart, Mr. Fonfara, says, hey, the people say that he got the risk assessment test, but we have no way of knowing that. Or, you know, we've tried to confirm that. Can you respond to that?
I believe in the record that we've received here, it contains a the sex offender evaluation that was performed for his resentencing at the after his probation was revoked, and that it indicates that that testing was performed in connection with that.
Before he was sentenced or after?
Before he was resentenced after his probation was revoked.
But you're understanding that there was, in fact, those tests were, in fact, performed?
Yes, and I can get in my... Get a
that was my understanding from the briefs, but I don't know.
I believe that's what the record reflects, is that it contains the PSI, including the sex offender evaluation that was performed before his resentencing.
Okay, so we'll go back and we'll look at that. So
okay.
Let's assume for purposes of this discussion, since we have to go back and check it,
mm-hmm.
Let's assume for purposes of the discussion that he was tested prior to the resentencing. Then what is your position about mootness at that point?
My position is that the sentence that he is appealing now, his prior sentence to probation, is no longer in effect. In his current sentence does not have the infirmity that he's alleging occurred here. So there is no issue for this court to rule on as to whether that prior sentence was illegal.
So the fact that counsel has stated that he's appealing both sentences doesn't affect this analysis? In other words, the original sentence is now dissolved somehow because he's been resentenced on the probation violation and it can't be appealed? Should we be dismissing the appeal of the original sentence?
Mm-hmm. Now, there's some, I'll be quite frank here, there's some... there was an issue here with as regards to these appeals being consolidated. When I wrote my answer brief, I was unaware that there was another appeal out there that had been consolidated into this one. However, I believe the opening brief is quite clear that it is challenging only the sentencing in the initial sentence and the trial court's order on March 10th, 2011, denying his claim that that was illegal. Looking at pages 2 and 3 of his opening brief.
And that's the sentence to probation.
And that was his initial sentence to probation. So I believe that while that the other case may have been consolidated into this case, that the decision to what he's limited to what he's raised in his opening brief and what I've responded to, which is all related to the initial sentence that he received. And indeed, the record that I have does not contain the revocation proceedings. So I'm other than it does appear to contain the pre-sentence investigation report and sex offender evaluation that was performed before that. But I don't know what happened at that revocation and what claims he may have brought there. And theoretically, I suppose there may be some claim that his probation was improperly revoked because of some infirmity in his prior sentence, but I just don't have that claim before us here, so I think there's nothing for this court to rule on.
Okay, so assuming that assuming that he's properly appealed the original probationary sentence,
mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to understand. You indicated that since that sentence has been revoked and he's been resentenced,
mm-hmm.
that the original sentence is not subject to attack at this point, is what I think I hear you saying. Do you have any authority for that?
The authority I have is just the general authority that the claim is rendered moot when it's no longer, there's no longer a remedy available to solve any infirmity that may have occurred with it.
Let me probe a little further.
Sure.
And ask about the flip side of what I asked you earlier. What I asked you was, and again, we'll go back and I check the record, but earlier I asked you to assume that the risk assessment occurred prior to resentencing, and I got your response to that. Now I would like you to respond to an assumption that the risk assessment occurred in prison after the resentencing. Does that change your analysis at all?
So after his resentencing? No, it does not, in the sense that I would still contend he may then have had a claim that his subsequent sentence had the same infirmity that he's claiming that his initial sentence had, if that makes sense. But I don't believe that, that the propriety of that sentence is before this court in this appeal, given the opening brief that was filed and the claims that were raised there. So I don't think it would affect the outcome on that basis.
So he would be barred from bringing it because he didn't include it in his opening brief?
Because he has not challenged it. He's not challenged his subsequent sentence, at least to my reading of the opening brief, yes.
Okay.
Or any of his briefing.
Were the cases consolidated prior to briefing?
The cases were consolidated prior to briefing. After I received this court's notification of oral argument, and I noticed that there were...
I only have one set of briefs. There's not been a set
right,
of briefs filed in any other case.
That's the only set of briefs, so after okay. that I'm aware of. After I received that and I noticed that there were two case numbers, I went down to the clerk's office and asked them about it, and they indicated, and I can get you the dates here that I got from them. They indicated that the notice of appeal in the second, this is 11 CA 1909 case, was filed on September 19th, 2011, and that an order consolidating it with this case issued on January 23rd, 2012. And then the opening brief in this case was filed on March 13th, 2012.
So if at this point, and it's my recollection this is the case, the opening brief does not discuss the second sentencing.
That's correct.
Then it would be abandoned in any event.
That would be our position, yes. And you know, the primary argument that I've made here, an oral argument, is that regardless of whether it's moot, that this is simply a time-barred claim, the challenge to his initial sentence here. And that if that's the case, then it fails on that basis, and this court does not necessarily need to reach the question of whether it's moot.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Yes, you may. Thank you.
I want to posit to the court that there was not a risk assessment done prior to the second sentencing or the revocation. The only risk assessment that was done throughout this entire proceeding for Mr. Kaywood was the first one, which was done 16 months prior to the second sentence.
Well, my question to you is, do you argue that in the briefs?
I did, yes.
On the second sentencing?
Yes, we did argue that it was not done at all. And I would say, as far as the second appellate situation went, we were just notified that it was consolidated. At no time were we given any opportunity to address that issue or to object to the consolidation of it. We just got a notice from the court that it was consolidated into the first brief, and that's as far as we're going, which is why that I requested oral arguments on this, as I wanted to cover that point, because the second sentencing was not covered well in the first brief, but it was mentioned. And I do want to reiterate that as far as the second one, certainly there was no risk assessment given. And as far as even the first sentencing, the risk assessment was given 16 months prior to the actual sentencing, which is impermissible. And in that, which leads to my next point of my presentation, is that in essence, because the statutory scheme was not complied with by the courts, that divests the courts of jurisdiction to sentence. That's a mandatory requirement by the legislature. It is not discretionary. It is not something that the court can decide to do away with. And so there should have been a risk assessment given before the actual sentencing. And when we say the second sentencing, I want to clarify to be sure that we all understand there was the first sentencing that occurred on July 8th of 2008, and the second one was a revocation of what we contend is an illegal sentence. And therefore,
a revocation of a probation which should not have been granted.
Exactly, Your Honor. Precisely. We feel that that probation should not have been granted, and that's actually the gravamen of the legislative scheme, is that in order to do probation, they require the risk assessment to be given for two purposes. One is to formulate the treatment that the person, the defendant, would need, and secondly, to ascertain whether the person would be an acceptable risk for the community. And so for that reason, the legislature was very serious in demanding that particular assessment that was not given. And there's a plethora of case law that says that noncompliance with the statutory scheme, which I didn't mention in my opening brief, which, if nothing else, is People versus Carbajal, states that non-adherence, noncompliance with the statutory scheme divests the court of jurisdiction to sentence. Consequently, without jurisdiction, it is a void sentence. And so, in summary, and I see I'm about out of time.
Well, counsel,
you are out of time, counsel, but Judge Roman has another question.
The clock is counting up.
Yeah, you actually...
You're a minute over, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Judge Roman has a question.
But I do have a follow-up question. Mr. Swanson indicated that his primary argument is the time-barred argument, and he noted the People versus Collier case. Are you familiar with that case, first of all? How is this case different than Collier?
Collier, if I recall correctly, was given the risk assessment. He just argued it wasn't complete. Our position is that Mr. Caywood was not given a risk assessment at all, which is mandatorily required. And as I understand it, and there are criteria for that, SOMB, the Sex Offender Management Board, does set forth criteria for the evaluations. But in Collier, it was given, it just was not given, in at least according to Mr. Collier, in compliance with the requirements.
But from a time bar analysis, how is it different?
Okay, my analysis on that, Your Honor, is as far as the time bar goes, the 120-day requirement, is that because it was not given at all, there was no compliance whatsoever with the statutory scheme. While in Collier, and the argument Collier goes, and the decision is founded upon the fact that it was given and there was compliance with the statutory scheme, it is our position that noncompliance with the statutory scheme eliminates jurisdiction on the part of the trial court to sentence. And if that's the case, it's a void sentence. And 35A and 35C, when we filed our motion under both, states that a lack of or a void or illegal sentence can be raised at any time. Therefore, the 120-day requirement does not apply.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. You agree that the sentence was within the parameters of the statute with respect to its length and type?
I would agree that the sentence that Mr. Caywood was given is in compliance with the statute in terms of the penalty phase, length and time, yes.
Are you familiar with any case that defines an illegal sentence as anything other than being within the statutory range of the sentencing statute?
I'm familiar with several cases, People versus Carbajal for one, which I mentioned, that states that noncompliance with the statutory scheme renders it to be a void sentence. And in answer to your question, I might take a different direction if it pleases the court, in that my research has shown me nothing that says that statutory compliance relates only to the penalty portion of the sentence. In other words, it simply says statutory compliance, which I think a better analysis is that it means exactly what the plain English says, which is statutory compliance, which means the entire statute, not merely length and time. I believe that's a narrow construction that is not the best construction.
Okay.
Thank you. Hearing no further questions from the panel, sir, your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. The court.